Hello, and welcome to the Comic Book Page Podcast. My name is John Mayo.
And I'm Bob Retall.
All right, this is Publisher Spotlight number 7. We're covering the DC 2.0 Week 2. This is the second week of a new 52. We obviously are still covering a DC book every Monday on the Weekly Comic Spotlight, and we'll obviously continue doing that as long as those episodes keep running pretty much forever. But since they're doing all these new number ones, we figured let's go cover everything just so we can kind of weigh in on what they're doing. So we're going to cover the other dozen or so books that relaunched this week, which is the week of September 14th, 2011. And we're just going to go through in alphabetical order. That seemed to be the most logical way to do it. So we're going to start with Batman and Robin number 1. Now, this is a series that followed up from the pre-Flashpoint Batman continuity pretty much seamlessly. I mean, even the costume change, while there, seems to be kind of downplayed a bit. It's not really that big of a deal or that noticeable. And it's funny, as I was starting this thing up, it's like we get what looked like a really weird Batman, and it's like, oh, this is the Batman from Moscow. This is apparently the Moscow agent of Batman Inc. or whatever. And I'm like, well, geez, he didn't last long. And turns out, actually, he lasted longer than I thought. We see him later in the issue, and I'm like, really? That's surprising.
Maybe he recruited KG Beast.
Actually, that would be funny. That I hadn't even thought about that. That would work.
That guy was pretty hard to kill.
Yeah. So. Well, it's funny because this is one where they're really kind of shifting the tone and style of Batman a bit. And it's a nice shift of Batman no longer focusing less on the night of his parents' death to their wedding anniversary and kind of a brighter, I don't say a brighter, cheerier Batman, I don't think there's really such a thing, but less of a angst-ridden, death-driven kind of a thing. And, I mean, the cynic in me really wonders, how long is that shift going to last? Because it seems like we're always going to go back to the basics, it's always the death of his parents that's going to go back to it. But this is a nice attempt to shift away from that to a more positive, upbeat kind of a thing. And this is really the first comic where we get Batman and Robin as Bruce Wayne and Damian Wayne. And Damian's a fun character. He's a smart aleck, he's a bit of a jerk and stuff, but he's smart and he's talented. So it's like, okay, it makes for a fun dynamic, and he's young. So, and I get him being a jerk to Tim Drake, Dick Grayson, the Titans, all the other, you know, I don't say peer group or whatever, but that group. But the way he acts towards Bruce just really was surprising, and the way Bruce has to kind of, you know, get him in line. I mean, it makes for a very different dynamic with a father and son Batman and Robin team than we've seen before, and I'm looking forward to that. You know, go ahead.
I was on a little bit on the fence on that because, I mean, he's always been kind of a jerk, but he seemed more jerky in sort of a mean-spirited way than normal. I mean, basically just like mocking Bruce for most of the issue for feeling sad about his dead parents. You know, it's like, that's, you know, it's like kind of, you know, pretty bad, I thought. I don't know.
Well, and when Bruce has to basically say, show some respect, these were your grandparents, you know? It's like, some of it may just be a defense mechanism. He's unsure how to relate to his father, all that kind of stuff, but it didn't totally play out that way. You know, and I don't know about that dynamic and how that's going to go. Overall, I like the art here. I think Patrick Leeson's, by and large, a really good artist. But there are a couple of places where the art was just good, not great. I mean, the two-page splash just after the staple was nice, and I liked it, but it didn't really wow me. That having been said, on the next page after that, we get Robin pummeling one of these guys, and we kind of rapid-fire punches or whatever. I love that shot of Damian. It's great. I mean, he's just kind of, you know, putting some thought in. He's got his tongue sticking out. He's deep in thought or whatever. It showed his character and his skill very well. So I don't think the art's bad anywhere in here, but there are a couple of places where there were opportunities for it to have been better. But again, I was very pleased with that. I do question whoever runs this Gotham University because they've got this research reactor. Okay, fine. They're an upbeat, upscale university. They're going to have their own little nuclear reactor. I question the intelligence of that, but fine. They're out on the edge there. But it's apparently underneath the swimming pool for the athletic team or whatever.
Yeah, it seems ill-advised, although it worked out in the end, right?
It worked out, but I mean, OSHA violations out the wazoo. It's like, come on.
Well, to be fair, that is lead-enriched water in the swimming pool to
Weigh down the swimmers, get them
yeah.
trained up or something.
Kind
Yes,
of block the
jeez.
radiation that might leak off of the nuclear reactor.
Now, I'm sure that the NAIR team, NAIR, is some kind of nuclear response team or whatever, but hey, it wouldn't hurt to have a little, footnote explaining that or something for those of us who haven't memorized every acronym out there.
I thought that was the team that helped superheroines not have hair on their legs, but
That could be too. I doubt it, but who knows? That's just the kind of in, I don't say in joke, but you know what I mean, accessibility thing. What would it have cost them to say, hey, to spell out the name and tell us what it means, basically, not a big deal, but hey.
on that same page with the Nair is opposite the New Guardians ad. To the left of the swimming pool is our Harbinger sighting for the episode, for the issue.
Who is woefully out of scale. She's about even with all those swimmers in the pool that seem a lot tinier. But that's actually the people on the far side of the pool must be giants then. I don't know. The scale seemed a little off. But yes, that is where she is. Again, with the red glow. The one question I had on this nuclear incident we have happening here, I'm wondering if we just saw the origin of a firestorm. Because the guys who are there are Robbie, Ronnie, and Robbie. Or Reggie. Reggie, Robbie, and Ronnie. Ronnie, of course, being one of the guys at the Pittsburgh University or whatever in the original Firestorm who got merged with Professor Stein to become Firestorm. Obviously, this would not be that Firestorm, but they sure seem to be getting into some kind of bizarre kind of a thing there in that accident. So, don't know if that ties in or not, but kind of curious. And I will say this, nobody we get in the framing sequence at the beginning and end over in Moscow seemed like kind of an interesting villain. Not crazy about that weird mask he's got, but hey, they've got a. And I don't know if we've seen him before or not. I'm assuming not, but I don't remember. I mean, overall, I like the issue. I thought it did a good job kind of setting up this Batman and Robin team. But again, it pretty much follows seamlessly on from the pre-Flashpoint stuff. So if you've been liking Batman and Robin and stuff before, granted, this is now the Bruce Wayne Batman. You'll probably like it now too.
Yeah, I was not I didn't love it. I didn't hate it. This is one of the ones that kind of went into my holding zone. It didn't go right onto my pull list, but it didn't get dismissed either. So, and interestingly, this was kind of in the same place as that when Steven, my son's been reading them, and I asked him to kind of rate all the books on, whether there's something he definitely wants to read again, whether he, maybe give it another couple of issues or ones he doesn't want to keep reading. Now, for him, it's very interesting because since I buy the comics, it's like when he says he doesn't want to read it, there's no cost involved, right? It's like it's there, it's free if he wants to read it. And, there's a bunch of books he just like, I don't want to read another issue of that. I don't care how
That
much it
translates
costs.
to it's a waste of his time to read.
Right. He, much to my benefit, did not like Damian mocking Batman about his dead parents. He said he should show more respect for his father.
Yes,
Good boy.
that's good son, good son.
So anyway, I gave it I think it was about a 3 out of 5 issue for me. It was an okay issue. It didn't quite sell me though.
I gave it a 4, granted a low 4, because I thought it did a good job kind of setting some stuff up. But for getting new readers and stuff, I really don't think they did an effective job. And I can certainly see the 3 rating you give it there. This goes to the comment I made on the Weekly Comic Spotlight this week of they're making this big to-do, this big promotional push of, oh, it's new, it's interesting, all that kind of fun stuff. And they're not doing anything bad or anything, but they're not highly accessible, highly exciting, highly, wow, I can't wait for the next issue hooks on most of these issues. Granted, not every book's going to be a 5 out of 5 or whatever, but it's weird how that's kind of going. I mean, this next book is a great example of that. Batwoman number one. There's something funny about a title relaunching with its own number one, essentially. Because this is the same Batwoman number one we would have gotten back when they had first promised it way back when. And it's good, but it's not like there's a definitive post-Flashpoint aspect to this. This followed on seamlessly from the pre-Flashpoint stuff.
Yeah, and the thing about that is I thought it followed on really well from the Batwoman, well, I guess Batwoman Zero that came out back when, and also Elegy that was in
Detective.
But I didn't think it did in a particularly effective job of introducing Kate Kane, and, you know, might have been somewhat confusing to a new reader just kind of picking this up off of, you know, the rack and never having seen this before.
Yes. It gets low marks on that kind of accessibility for new readers, I think.
I loved it. You know, it's like I love J.H. Williams, the panel layouts, the design, the art, and all that. But then Steven read it, and it was red for him. He's like, I don't want to read another issue of that. He's like, he didn't know what was going on. And, you know, so it was kind of funny, you know, very opposite reactions. But I thought it was very well done. But there were a couple of things that puzzled me about this.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Kate Kane is drawn with, like, this really white skin, and not just when she's Batwoman. I mean, when she's talking to Maggie Sawyer, she's got just, like, this vampire white skin, like, almost like she's got, like, white kabuki makeup on or something, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I don't recall her having this bizarrely white skin back in Detective. Maybe she did.
I think they set her up as having that. Okay.
It's just funny.
I don't like it either.
Because it's unnatural. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not like pale. You know, I live in a house full of redheads, and they're pale, you know, but they're not white like this. This is not pale. This is bizarre.
Opposite the Midtown Comics ad, we've got Detective Sawyer and Kate there. And Sawyer is, you know, pale, Caucasian. And then, like you said, Kate there is clown white. And it to me, it's clearly she's got makeup on, that kind of a thing. Now, it may simply be to hide any bruises she gets as Batwoman or something, but that's not really established here.
Here's the thing, though. I mean, look at the double-page spread where they're changing clothes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if she's wearing white makeup, wouldn't that sort of cover up those tattoos she's got?
Good point. I stand corrected then.
She's certainly not wearing grease paint. You know, it's like, it almost looks like it. It's so white. It's just weird.
At one point, she had regular skin color, and now she's clearly an albino.
It doesn't, I mean, I still love the thing, but that really was weird to me. And I don't, maybe if somebody understands something that I don't, or there's some panel somewhere or something that explains this, if you could come on the forum and tell us about it or send us an email or something, I would really appreciate it because I can't figure it out. It's just strange to me.
I'm sure there's something in the Detective Comics run or one of the other things, such as maybe the, what was the one that, wasn't she in one of the ones that had Vandal Savage and the Mark of Cain or whatever and all that stuff?
Yep.
And she might have gotten changed there or something, I forget. Yep. When I know that had the question, get the mark on her at one point. But for me, that goes down to kind of the art. And I think it's great art, both in terms of the drawing, individual panels, and the layouts are just amazing. And, you know, the use of the colors here is really good. The reds really kind of pop as they should. I'm going to concede the white skin aspect entirely. I agree with that. The one thing that also struck me as interesting, and I want to see if you had kind of the same take on it as I did, opposite the Onion News Network ad, There's this one panel that's black and white for the most part with the photo of Renee Montoya in color.
Uh-huh.
Do you watch Psych?
I have seen it before. It's like when that guy is like zoning in on some clue and they kind of do the thing, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You got a guy who's observant and he's seeing the vital clue that everyone else is missing. You get kind of the sound effect. And this, to me, was the equivalent of that, I guess. It was a little unclear what they were trying to do there.
I was kind of wondering, I mean, usually that kind of a wall is like fallen officers. So is Renee Montoya dead in this continuity? Or do they think she's dead? And maybe, you know, she's the question, but she's presumed dead or something. I don't know. But, I mean, it seemed like something like that, and it wasn't clear.
Yeah, that does make sense. It does fit with the fallen officer sort of thing.
Now, one other thing. I go back to that double-page spread where they're changing clothes.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I thought was kind of neat on it was you got that panel where they're kind of jumping and tumbling across the rooftops that kind of mm-hmm. spreads across the two pages. On the left side, you've got kind of like a bat kind of thing. And on the right side, it's more like a bird kind of a thing.
Oh, the flame bird. I hadn't even noticed
that.
Yeah,
so I'm wondering if that'll be the identity where she's, you know, just...
That was her identity.
No, I'm saying, but... In the, you know, they haven't, she hasn't given her the identity yet, right?
It's like giving it back.
She's calling her plebe, you know, and this kind of stuff.
Yeah, but on the previous page, what I found very interesting here, because as we first get Betty here, who used to be Flamebird, at least pre-Flashpoint, I'm like, well, I wonder if she still is. And then we clearly get here that she had the Flamebird costume, so clearly she was. She mentions having been a Teen Titan before. Which makes, because I was wondering if the Teen Titans still happened or not, and apparently they did, maybe not how we saw it previously, but in some respect. Now, the other thing that's really interesting about that sequence with them tumbling on the roof is we get like four different shots of them as they're coming from the far rooftop onto the main one and then tumbling out. And in that third one, the rightmost on the left-hand page, Batwoman's going over something and... you know, Betty is apparently going behind it or something, and we kind of get a panel inset to push behind that wall so we could see what she's doing, which I thought was interesting.
I think it's like a pipe, and she's just going under the pipe.
Oh, maybe you're right.
And the other one's going over it.
Never mind.
Something else is kind of weird on that panel, and it's like I'm a connoisseur of superheroine's underwear, apparently. But as they're putting on their costumes here on this page, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, Kate has got a bra, and Betty does not have a bra, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you go where they're changing again, I don't know why they're like just like showing them change clothes a lot. Now, all of a sudden, Betty has a bra on, and Kate doesn't. I mean, maybe there's, you know, other... scenes that happen here that they don't show, but it just seems kind of weird. You know, they have the magical power to switch underwear or something while in costume. It's just funny.
It's a continuity glitch, certainly. What I found interesting on that page when they're getting, you know, out of costume and stuff is they're talking about Q-Ball and the Pool Hall Gang and how they're a total joke or whatever. And we actually get inset panels where they're fighting this billiard-themed team. And I'm like, you know, it's kind of silly, but I think it'd be fun to see more of them. They strike me as the Royal Flush Gang equivalent for Gotham. And it just seemed like it would be, you know, good cannon fodder. It's the kind of thing that you could reuse the team a bit, and I'd like to see that. Simple costumes, easy theming, whatever.
I also like that there's kind of a different, subtly different art style when she's Batwoman and in costume than when she's Kate.
There are a couple of different.
It's a little more. It's a little more painted looking when she's in costume, and a little more line art looking when she's not.
Well, and then also go to the page where we get the Department of Extra Normal Operations, which apparently still exists. Mr. Bones is still there. That seemed to have, well, more the line work, a different kind of a line work than we're seeing when we're getting the flashback of Kate's past and stuff. So, I mean, J.H. Williams is really doing a lot with the art styles here and kind of mixing and matching different, you know, styles as appropriate and stuff, and it works surprisingly well. in the hands of a lesser artist, this could just be a mishmash of things that don't work.
Yeah. Tremendous amount of design goes into this book.
Also, if you go to the page where we're getting the flashback of her backstory, upper right, we see her in her Navy uniform without the white skin. So I'm thinking something happened to her that I simply am not remembering off the top of my head that put her into the current albino state.
Yeah, that's what I'm like. If somebody knows what that is, just drop us a line. So I'm figuring something happened. It doesn't. That seems like too big of a thing for it to be a mistake. I'm just missing something somewhere.
Yeah. Well, it's been long enough since we saw the last Batwoman story too. It's been over a year, and I've read in that time probably 2,000-3,000 comics.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you've read as much, if not more. So. It's harder for me to remember some of the details on that kind of stuff. And that's something that would make sense for them to have put into, I don't know, a first issue. But again, from the way this was originally crafted, I don't think it was meant to be a first issue necessarily.
Yeah. Now we have our Harbinger sighting on the two-page spread with the weeping woman, I'll say. We've got the upper right panel where you got Jim Gordon talking to Maggie Sawyer. And kind of in the middle of that, near the bottom, right above the word balloon that says, come again, there's a little tiny Harbinger head
Kind
of standing in the crowd.
It did seem like they, I don't want to say had to shoehorn that kind of stuff in some issues, but...
Well, obviously on this one, because I think this was completed pretty much prior to the relaunch coming around, so probably just like painted that in.
Yeah. What I found interesting was that last story page, kind of that cameo by Batman there. He's just been in a ton of books. And I'm kind of curious how they're going to set the relationship between these characters going forward. Overall, I thought this was a good first issue. It helps to know the backstory for the character, but I think they gave a lot of the essentials here. And if you like this, certainly go check out Batwoman's previous appearances, especially the stuff you were mentioning over in Detective Comics with the Elegy or whatever storyline.
That was really good stuff. I gave this a really high 4 out of 5, and this made it onto my pull list.
Yeah. I would give this a very solid 4 out of 5 artistically. 5 out of 5, no question. Again, I think the page layouts, the use of the color, if you're looking for what can be done artistically in a comic that really kind of is stretching the borders and pushing the boundaries, check out what J.H. Williams is doing on Batwoman. It's definitely more than just the standard 9-panel grid or anything remotely like that.
Next up, we've got Deathstroke. I'm going to just get right out there is that conceptually, I have a little bit of a problem of reading books where the main guy is like a sociopath assassin. So it kind of colors my perception of the whole book. I mean, it's just, Punisher kills people, but theoretically he's had this tragic life event. He was trained as a killing machine in the Marines and he's killing bad guys. Here you got a guy who just kills people.
I disagree with that. I think as they have set him up here, he is certainly a mercenary for hire. There's the implication he might have his own code of conduct. Is it necessarily one that makes you want to hang around with the guy? No.
And the end of the issue,
mm-hmm.
which I don't want to spoil, but...
With the coworkers?
That's kind of sociopathic, I would say.
I would say it's pragmatic. I'm not going to say it's not sociopathic as well, but there is a pragmatic aspect.
Sure.
Of... Why wait for tomorrow to deal with the problem today? You could deal,
I just don't need to read a book like that.
Oh, is it an endearing character trait? Certainly not. No question about that.
So I guess my bottom line that I was trying to make is no matter how well executed it is, I personally don't want to read a book about this character.
Well, it almost seems like the better executed it is, the less likely you'd want to read it.
That's correct.
I can understand that. This was one going in, I was not overly excited about. I've read most of Deathstroke's appearances since he was originally introduced in the New Teen Titans and stuff. I think this issue did a very good job kind of setting up his current status quo. didn't really clarify a lot about his backstory and how that may have changed pre or post Flashpoint, if at all. Yeah, his armor and look are updated, but this is pretty much the same character we've known for years, maybe. I mean, this could follow on from the pre-Flashpoint stuff where we saw him in Titans, and it may not. And he's very much a professional mercenary, does a lot of bodyguard jobs, and there was an aspect of that that made me think, well, it's not like he's being hunted by the cops and every other, you know, Interpol police agency type thing on the planet or anything. Apparently, this bodyguard type thing is giving him an image problem. Maybe he's too soft or something. That was a little unclear exactly what the deal was there. We never find out what's in this briefcase thing that's sending some kind of a message. No doubt we'll find that out later, but it was kind of unclear. I mean, they're setting up some mysteries around the character. People want him dead. They're trying to send him a message. What's going on there? But it was not set up as well here as, say, what we got in Resurrection Man with that kind of grand overarching storyline. Here it's okay, there's more to be had, but I'm not quite sure exactly where it's going or what's going on there. It was more entertaining and more to my liking than I was really expecting. I mean, they promised that they were going to have the finest in mayhem and gore. I'm not a big fan of gore, as everyone should probably know listening to this podcast. I really don't like it at all.
They had more gore in Green Lantern than they had in this issue.
Yeah, there are a couple of people getting their heads whacked off, but even that was almost done in a comically fashion, which I doubt was the artist's intention, but it didn't seem gross.
I was not that big of a fan of the art in this issue, personally. I mean, I don't think there was anything wrong with it, you know, storytelling-wise or anything like that. It just wasn't that appealing to my eye. And that's more of a personal judgment than anything to do with anything. I don't think there was anything wrong with the art. It just didn't appeal that much to me.
Interesting. I didn't really have any problem with that. I think there were a couple of places where the dark was used and stuff was a little excessive or whatever. But I found the art more to my liking than I had expected. Again, expecting more of a gory art style and art depiction.
You know what I'm looking at? It. There's a lot of very angular lines. You know.
Yeah.
It just maybe that's what it is. But anyway, it just didn't feel that organic to me. Not a big fan. Interestingly, though, this one was one that I had on the boy. I don't ever want to read another one of these again. And Steven read it, and he was like, "Oh, I love that!" It's like it was one of his top books of the week. So.
Hmm.
They're hitting a good demographic there.
You know, so, well, I don't know. You buy a lot more comics than he does.
I know. Well, I guess the thing is, it's like, if he loves it that much, do I want to get it? You know, I don't know. Might move it up to On the Fence, you know, from absolutely no, you know, on my side.
For me, at this point, I'm going to stick with it. That may change depending on the level of gore and so forth. Certainly not in love with it, but I thought it did a good job kind of setting things up. So for me, it was a 4. I'm not going to say an overly strong one, but it was better than average and really better than I had expected. What would you rate this as?
I gave it a 3. Okay. Again, I thought it was fine. I just didn't particularly care for the character. That's nothing against the execution, particularly.
Well, it seems like it was a hard sell going in for you, and I can understand that. And there are some that just aren't going to click with somebody.
Well, I mean,
for
I've read
reason.
Deathstroke books before, so yeah. It's more like this particular interpretation of him, particularly his dealing with his colleagues at the end, you know, that kind of pushed it over the edge for me.
Interesting.
I mean, because okay. It's one thing when he's out, like, you know, with his general mayhem of, you know, fighting along and stuff, but. Dealing with his teammates in that fashion was uncalled for, while making sense from a business point of view, I suppose. But
yeah, again, doesn't make you want to work with him. The sighted of the Hooded Woman actually took me a while to find in this one. She's hidden on the first page, third panel, far left, and part of what makes her hard to spot is the red she is in goes with the orange background very nicely.
And no glow.
That was another one where it's like, crap, we got to find a crowd scene to toss her in.
Yeah, kind of blocky and non-feminine looking, particularly, you know, in that one.
And again,
it could be the artist.
It's going to be interesting to see if they go anywhere with that stuff or not. At this point, it's a Where's Waldo for me, still.
Next up is Demon Knights, Paul Cornell. We are set 4 centuries ago. Seems like it would be more than 4 centuries ago, doesn't it?
Yeah. What I liked was not so much that they set it up 4 centuries ago. Okay, that's handy, that's nice, whatever. But starting the story clearly on the fall of Camelot, the death of King Arthur, firmly establishes the relevant relative time for the intro. It's, I mean, 4 centuries ago, 5 centuries ago, whatever. I want to know the relative time frame that's important in here. It's the fall of Camelot. You know, it's like, okay, that anchors the story how I need it to be anchored better than really what year it was. So I was pleased with that. It does get a little unclear once they leave that and get to the title page where it's, quote-unquote, now, the Dark Ages, how much time has elapsed. I'm kind of guessing maybe 100 years or so, based on Jason's comment about how he and Madame Xanadu had last seen Vandal Savage like 90 years ago or whatever. Now, going into this, I was thinking, you know, I like Paul Cornell's writing. He's done some good stuff. The demon is not a character I like, so I really was not expecting to like this title much, if at all. There are a lot of things about the demon that just turn me off, the rhyming couplets and all that kind of crap. But I was really pleased with this issue. You know, we got a good intro to the demon. We got a good intro to Jason, who apparently guy just has really bad timing. If somebody else had interrupted Merlin at that time, he'd have been better off. But you know, we got a lot of, for me, unexpected. Oh, I didn't expect this character or that one or this one or that one. And it was fun. It was interesting. It was obviously a team book. I was focusing more on the demon aspect going in than the knights aspect. I like this a lot more than I expected. Vandal Savage was fun. Mordru was a interesting character to have in there. The new Sir Justin the Shining Knight, very different from the classic version. Very curious where they're going to go with that character. But, you know, again, I like the look. It had kind of a Loki vibe. But then we've also got this, a couple of characters are really only barely introduced, like this Al-Jabbar Exorcisos or whatever, what looks to be an Amazon. And really, this is almost coming out to be like a Justice League medieval, which I'm perfectly fine with. I think that's actually kind of cool, you know? So I came out of this thinking that, again, a lot better than I was expecting. I don't know how long I'm going to feel that way, but for now I'm going to keep getting the title. And part of what pushed me over the top was the love triangle they introduce
Jason, Demon, and Madame Xanadu, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, who is she playing? Is she playing the demon? Is she playing Jason? Is she playing both?
Yep.
And that seems like if there's a breakup to be had, nobody's going to come out of it well. So I was, again, very very impressed by this, and it worked a lot better. This was one I was expecting to read, not really like, and give a low rating to, and just, it's like, it's just not for me. But complete opposite. This is one that, had I had to be so very selective on what I picked up off the rack, never would have gotten into my pile, never would have read, and I would have been the worse off for it, I think.
Yeah, this one I loved. This was actually my favorite book of the week. It was for most of the reasons that you said. I also liked Sir Justin, the Shining Knight, coming in. It looks like they're using the Grant Morrison take on Shining Knight from his Seven Soldiers. I think it was...
Yeah, you're right. I'd forgotten about
kind
that,
of,
actually.
Cross-dressing woman in the Shining Knight armor as opposed to the classic Sir Justin. It's Sir Yustin or something. But it's a woman, right?
Yeah.
But I like you said, I really liked that Xanadu, Jason, demon thing, you know, and just, you know, how really nice dialogue pieces and just really good setup. And Vandal Savage I really liked too, you know. It's just, there's all these different characters that playing them off of each other like this was really effective. And I thought Paul Cornell did a really good job on it. I'm looking forward to seeing how this goes. And it is kind of set kind of off on the side because it's so many years in the past, you know, what Dark Ages were, 1,000, 1,100, 1,200, whenever that was. You know, so it's a long way in the past. Now, the fact that we see the hooded woman on the title page there, you know, popping around, not just, you know, sort of 5 years ago, now she's popping around hundreds and hundreds of years ago as well.
Well, and the question is that her from then? Is it her from now? In other words, is she time traveling or really long lived? I mean, again,
yeah.
questions are being raised by that, and we'll find out as things go. I will admit there was the temptation after, you know, finishing this to try to map these characters onto a Justice League kind of classic lineup or whatever, which of course is a fool's errand, but certainly I do see that kind of a parallel, kind of a precursor to the Justice League Dark that we're going to get. I'm hoping that overall they you know, introduce Gem World aspects and other, you know, those sorts of things into this over time. But I mean, for me, this was, again, a solid 4 out of 5 and really one of the surprise, pleasant surprises of the week.
It's got a 5 for me, and I really liked a lot of the elements of it. They all just kind of worked together for me. I loved the art, too. Thought the art was really well-suited. Diogenes Nevis with Eau Claire Albert as the inker. I think those guys really did a good job of capturing the medieval time frame in some of the detail that you see. And again, kind of contrasting it to Batwing, you know, from last week. I felt that there was lots of mood in this from the just some of the details that you'd get in the backgrounds in the inn and, you know, some of the scenes. I mean, there were scenes that had minimal or no background, but they didn't stand out because they were not exclusively, you know, used. I mean, like, where Madame Xanadu's kissing the demon, for instance. I mean, there's no backgrounds on those panels, but then, you know, you get a feeling, you know, because there's background on some of the other panels that it exists, you know. It just, there was a good mixture, I guess, is the point I'm trying to make, is that, well, there was enough that you can take shortcuts in some places, and it doesn't jump out because you've put them in enough places.
Yeah, it felt like it was shot on location, if you will, because that bar, that inn they're in, is clearly well-trafficked, has a lot of people in there. So when we get that close-up on the kiss and stuff, do we expect to see everyone in the background? No. But it's clear that they're still there. You know, it's a well-grounded story in that respect. It gives a sense of believability and whatnot there.
And the thing that was interesting to me about it, because when I made that observation and I kind of went back to the issue, I mean, actually about half the panels in the issue really don't have backgrounds, but I didn't notice that. It didn't stand out to me.
But look at the page where we first see Vandal Savage and Sir Yustin.
Yeah.
Okay. When we first see Vandal, in the bottom corner in the background are Jason and Xanadu. Okay, so kind of, oh, they spotted him there kind of a thing. Very well done, easy to miss. On the top of the next page, where we're getting them talking at the table and stuff, and you know, Savage is going on and on, next to the first word balloon there, we've got the guy with the hood and stuff, who is Al-Jabbar or whatever, in the next page. He's already established there in the background, starting to talk to the innkeeper or whatever. That's something that, did it need to be there? No. But the fact it was there is that level of detail that's kind of subtly setting you, it's not a shock that he's there.
And the characters are just moving through the scene. You know, when you get to the page, you know, another one on where the horde kind of bashes through the door. You know, there you got Al-Jabbar standing there. You got, you know, Jason and Xanadu at the table. I love Xanadu, where she's got her head on her hand and she's just, you know, sigh, you know. And, you know, just little elements work really well for me.
Yeah.
Great issue. Very well done. Both art and writing firing on all cylinders for me. I love this one.
This is something that I don't think enough people will try out. And again, it was one that if I hadn't been getting all of them, this would have been one of the ones I would not have gotten. And I'm glad I did.
And that's something that is really interesting about the relaunch in general. Is that, you know, because, you know, I think I said the same thing last week, you know, it's like certain books that I wouldn't have particularly thought were going to be the ones that I'm liking, I love. And things that I, you know, thought that I'd love, I'm not liking. And
yeah,
it's very simple, I think, you know, and all I'm trying to say to people is if you read some of these DC ones and you didn't like them, don't turn your nose up at the whole relaunch, because try some of those other books you didn't try, because, you know, either of these 2 weeks, I could have picked up 5 or 6 books. And if I picked up the 5 or 6 books that overlap the, wow, I really didn't like that book set, I could think, oh, this relaunch is terrible. And I could have picked up five or six completely different books that are the ones that I totally loved and thought, wow, this is the greatest thing ever. You know, and what it really is that there's a wide variety of books out there, and some people are going to love books and other people are not going to like books, and that's perfectly fine. It's just there's so many different things to choose from. Poke around. You'll probably find a book or two that you're going to like.
Well, and the bottom line is don't judge books you haven't read. Don't prejudge them based on the solicit, based on the cover. Until you've actually gone through and read the book, you're not going to know if it's really going to click with you or not.
And don't go on reviews. I mean, we're reviewing these things. It's like, don't listen to me. You know, it's like, I'll tell you what my opinion is. I mean, I tell you why, right?
Listen to us, but make your own decision.
Right.
Use this to say, oh, well, they gave that a really good thing. Maybe I should check out Demon Knights and decide if I like it.
Right.
Because we're obviously not going to tell you that you definitely will. We don't know every reader out there, and every reader is different.
Yeah. Like, for instance, OMAC last week. Neither of us liked OMAC. But there are a lot of people that loved OMAC. It was their favorite book of the week, you know?
I still find that hard to believe. But okay, they like what they like.
It is,
that's fine.
Hey, you know, it's like, there were people Twittering on us. It was like, oh, I can't believe I listened and you guys didn't like OMAC. It was my favorite book of the week. And I tweeted back and I was like, hey, that's what's good about, you know, the relaunch is because, you know, something that you love and I love, you're not necessarily going to love. Something you love, I'm not necessarily going to love. But we each have things that we love, so that's the good thing.
Yeah.
You know, not the same things necessarily. I think this next book is going to be one of those. I've already seen that a lot of people really love this one, Frankenstein, Agent of Shade. And it didn't really work that well for me. I read this one, and again, you know, Jeff Lemire's writing it. I loved Animal Man. He wrote Animal Man. That was my favorite book of that week. This one, this was right up there with being my least favorite book of the week. And that's fine. You know, it's like, it's just something about it. And it didn't really click with me. The art, I was not a big fan of the art in this issue.
Neither was I. I like a tighter, more detailed style. There were a few places where it just, I don't want to say it looked badly drawn, but that's really what I'm thinking. I want to be more polite than that because nobody sets out to draw a bad book. But there was an aspect of this where there were things that felt a little unfinished, like in the second page when the kid's turning to face his grandfather or whatever, his head seems to be almost like it should be twisting and popping off at that point.
His body should be turned to get that much rotation.
Yes.
In the head.
And there's a bit more of a, I don't say a scribbly aspect in some places. It's not as tight of an art style as I tend to gravitate towards, and it seems like certain things are more implied than clearly drawn. So that made the art a little bit of a barrier into the story for me.
Well, the other thing is like on the title page, those big weird monsters, right?
Mm-hmm.
The art style there is almost like, and I don't think you read the Hellboy stuff, but it's more like a Guy Davis kind of set of monsters that would look very much at home in a BPRD comic book.
Or Proof.
Yeah, or Proof. It just, they didn't work for me there. Now, conceptually, well, you know, I kind of like the callback to Ray Palmer and the Ant Farm, but not enough to stick around. The guy who comes back kind of regenerated into a little girl body, I think some people think, oh, that's cool. I just thought that was kind of didn't work for me. I'll just be kind and say it like that.
That's Father Time, right?
Yeah.
Yet Frankenstein keeps referring to him as Father, which through the course of the story, he does that enough, I'm thinking, well, his creator would be his father, that must be his... Oh, wait, no, it's not his creator, that's Father Time. It didn't work well for me. It got a little confusing there. Now, as far as the Ray Palmer Ant Farm stuff, those are carryovers, again, from the Atom backup in Adventure Comics and that Atom one-shot Lemire did. I liked those. I thought those were good. That's kind of cool. He's the science liaison from the UN. How much of his backstory holds true, whatever, don't know. He's not enough necessarily to keep me coming back to this. But between the ant farm, the humanids or whatever, the mind portal, this was a lot more science fiction heavy than I was expecting, which was a pleasant surprise. I mean, the humanids or whatever, I'm like, well, what are those? And we get a quick explanation to that once Frankenstein gets to the ant farm and stuff. And that explanation really sounds like a story springboard to me. If we're going to have something where this, you know, was having them really a great idea or not, which is cool. Again, the guys, the girl, it doesn't work for me.
I'll tell you what, for a lot of it, I think it does come down to the art for me, because I look at the cover, by J.G. Jones. If the whole inside was by J.G. Jones and looked like the cover,
yeah,
I think this would be on my list. it's like, it really comes down to that. The art was really, really not to my liking in this, but, again, other people might really like it. It just didn't work for me.
It certainly was a hindrance for me. When we got the page that brings in the creature commandos, I didn't really think they were particularly, clearly drawn in some respects. And it's interesting because we get the one guy with the vampire crossbreeded with the Langstrom serum order. It's like, okay, Man-Bat probably still exists or whatever. So there's some Easter eggs. I like how they're tying this into the DC Universe. These creature commandos really got a good introduction in the Flashpoint series. So all we need is to say, yeah, they kind of still exist or whatever. But if it hadn't have been for that Flashpoint series, I'd be like, this is a poor introduction to them. And this is a number one. So I'm really still on the fence on this. I thought it was good, but not great. I'm going to give it the first story arc to either really hook me or not. But I agree with you that if, the entire thing had been done by J.G. Jones, this might be one that I would just be given a great rating to and just raving about, because I think it's got some really good ideas. Again, it's an interesting blend of the classic monster look with science fiction ideas, and has some fun concepts. But as it was, this was a three, a strong three, but just a three. And I was a little disappointed with that. I was hoping that this was going to be something that just really gave me more than I had expected.
For me, the art pulled this down into two territory.
I can see that.
We got our Harbinger sighting on this one on the two-page spread directly previous to the New Guardians ad. Kind of underneath the, foom blast from Frankenstein's pistol, kind of in the middle. You got the glowing Harbinger kind of like walking through the mayhem of the scene.
Yeah. Seems to have a bit of a tattered cloak on that one, too.
Oh, yeah.
And regular size hands.
Next up, we've got Green Lantern. I'm going to be really curious to see what you thought about this one.
I'm going to say flat out, I'm going to be pretty harsh on this one. I like Geoff Johns. I've liked the Green Lantern stuff. This follows up directly on the heels of the War of the Green Lanterns aftermath stuff. There's something really odd about a Green Lantern uttering the oath while being kept in chains by the Guardians. It's like kind of a mixed message there. Focusing on Sinestro, I'm fine with that. Hell, having a different Green Lantern, I really couldn't care. This is something that I really don't feel was geared towards accessibility for new readers. We get introduced to Hal as a guy who can't pay his bills, but why should we care? Who is Hal? If we don't know, we don't know. Granted, I do, because I've read about Hal, Carol, Sinestro, and all those for years. So this issue worked fine for me, but I think for new readers, not so much. And then we get this completely ludicrous scene where he sees what looks like domestic violence across the street, dives across from his balcony, fully across the street to the level even with him, able to crash through the window, deck the guy, only to find out, well, it's not quite what he thought. It's a movie being seen, and I'm like,
I was assuming it was like more of like a small alley as opposed to a street, but
even a small alley would be what, 10 feet?
Yeah.
How does he get enough height to get across that distance? I mean, the physics don't quite work, but hey, it's a comic, whatever. The part that surprised me was not that he was able to do it, but that he got arrested instead of being hired as a stuntman. If I'm sitting there filming this and I get this on camera and I see this guy, I'm like, that's the next Jackie Chan. I'm hiring him. He's in my neck. He's this movie. To hell with the plot we've got. I mean, this was some good stuff, but this is exactly the same kind of stuff we'd have gotten if Flashpoint hadn't happened. I don't know how this is going to work with new readers. The ending of it, kind of a surprise, kind of works, kind of curious about it. I mean, there was some good stuff, but I didn't leave with a satisfying enough chunk of story in some areas. And while I liked it and I thought it was good, I'm going to give it a 4. I was still disappointed with this. I expect better out of Geoff Johns. He is capable of better. This should have had me thinking, wow, this is why I love Green Lantern. And it didn't. What did you think?
I liked it. I liked it as issue 68 of Green Lantern.
Yes.
Basically, my thought on this is just as a number one issue, I thought it was really weak for all the reasons you articulated. Jumping across the alley didn't really bother me that much. But, it's just I thought that the introduction of the characters and setting up the status quo and all that, it was a very direct follow-on from the previous series and is significantly different from the movie that some people may have seen, at least more people than read comics. Even though the movie didn't do that well, it was probably seen by 20 or 30 times the number of people that read Green Lantern comics. You know, given that this is very different from the status quo there, they could have done a lot better job of setting this up and explaining what was going on and introducing things and, you know, all that. You know, I thought that was relatively weak. So it got a low 4 out of 5 for me on that. But as a comic, you know, and for me personally, since, you know, I read Green Lantern 67 and, you know, this is a good Green Lantern 68, you know, I'm going to buy it. You know, it just continues on the Green Lantern series for me. But, you know, it had some challenges.
I see it as a missed opportunity.
Yeah, you know? I mean, as one of the highest profile, I mean, after Batman, Superman, I mean, this is pretty much their highest profile property that they've got. And it just seems a little squandered.
I guess part of it for me is I can't help but read through a lot of these new number ones and think back to the Up, Up, and Away storyline we got in the Superman titles with 1 year later, where it was Kurt Busiek. I forget who did the art, but it was beautiful art. And it was one of those that really, you know, this is Superman. This is why I love Superman. This is why I like reading the comics and stuff. And it just clicked on so many aspects for me. And I'm really not seeing most of these properties, most of these new number ones. I'm not seeing that here. I'm not having quite the level of excitement exploring this new world and stuff that I had when we got the Teen Titans with 1 year later, when we got, you know, a lot of that other stuff. And that disappoints me, and particularly from Geoff Johns. I know he's capable of knocking our socks off. And you're right, he treated this like a subsequent issue of an ongoing series versus a new jumping on point.
And I'm always thinking, like, hey, you got your chief creative officer, it's like, is the editor, like, afraid to tell him, hey, Geoff, snap it up here, because he's the boss.
Well, the editor, and really this goes down to everybody else in any kind of position of power at DC who's been reading these things. You know, these were all read by Jim Lee, I would imagine, Dan Didio, Bob Wayne, a lot of these guys who've been around the block and know storytelling and stuff.
Did they just not put themselves into the position of someone coming at it with fresh eyes? Because it was perfectly fine as issue 68 of Green Lantern.
Yeah,
I don't think I'd be making any of these
4.
Comments,
yeah.
Right, as if it was issue 68 of Green Lantern, you know, I wouldn't be making any of these comments. But given that it's not issue 68 of Green Lantern, it's issue number 1 of Green Lantern, there are some things that should have been done differently for this book.
Yeah, yeah. I think we're on the same page on that, totally.
Yeah. So our Harbinger sighting is the page after the 52 all-new number 1s ad. Second panel from the bottom, you got a crowd scene. Usually that's the fair place to look for these. So you find the crowd scene in the issue where Hal is looking up into the sky, and there she is kind of glowing off in the lower left corner of that panel. Okay, next up we've got Grifter, number 1, by Nathan Edmondson with art by Kafu. Couple of things I noticed about the art. Now, Kafu has done art on several other things. Most notably that I remember is when he did that Vixen series.
Did some recent Thunder Agents, didn't he?
Yeah, he did Thunder Agents too. I remember liking the art on that more so than here. I don't know if it's changed or maybe it's just my memory is going off, but it seemed somehow more painty or something. I don't know what.
This did look a little different than the art style he's used in the other stuff, and I like the other art style better. And it's, I'd have to look at the two simultaneously to really kind of do a good comparison of it. But his art was actually, for me, one of the high points of the issue, even with all of that having been said. Yeah.
Now, this is the one I was alluding to when we were talking about Resurrection Man back on our weekly comic spotlight episode. You know, it's like, I don't know if Kaku has ever actually been on a plane in his life.
God. Yeah.
But there's stuff set in a plane. Most particularly, let me point out the third page of this story in the bottom left-hand panel where you have the woman with the knife and she's standing in between the seats. My God, what is that like? 4 feet or something?
Yeah,
like,
there's room
like
for somebody
ride
to pass
on this plane. That's more room than's in first class, and these guys are back in coach. You know,
she's standing up in front of the seat, and there's room for somebody to pass in front of her, and even a large somebody at that. The distance between the seats is got to be at least, it seems like, 4 to 6 feet or whatever between in the aisle or whatever. It's like, wow, the space. Scaling and stuff on this was ludicrous.
The door gets opened, and you actually can't open a door when you're flying. I know that it says you can override, but you really can't. And, you know, the explosive decompression was not really portrayed particularly well that you would see if somebody actually opened the door. It looks like a room. You know, when you look at that page that's to the left of the title page, you know, you don't have the curve of the plane. And I'm just obsessing about this. It's just, it's really terrible portrayal of a plane.
Well, that's the kind of thing that takes you out of the story. Now, I've got to wonder how much of that is Kafu maybe literally never having been on a jumbo jet, or the script by Edmondson basically trying to do things and saying, do this, that shouldn't and couldn't have been done. To me, this issue really started out on a bad foot, and I mean that literally, and specifically the foot on the first panel of the first page. We get a quote-unquote establishing shot at the New Orleans airport, and then we cut to the inside of an airplane in flight. What the hell? Why do we have an establishing shot, which is really poorly done, of an inside of an airport, and then cut to a plane? Why wasn't that just like a shot of the plane in flight? I mean, it's like it sets up the thing wrong. Then we get all this expansive jumbo jet type stuff, which again can kind of kick people out of the story. For me, the injury to eye panel on the fourth page, totally disgusting. I don't like that. That's just a hot button issue for me. We get to after that title page where you mentioned they're falling out of the plane and stuff. I'll leave the physics of could that be done or not to like the Mythbusters or something. I'm not going to say it can be. I'm not going to disagree with you at all. But man, even with that door open, it's huge. It's like a cargo door, not an airplane door. But then, boom, suddenly we cut to earlier.
I was on a plane one time when a guy tried to open the door. A guy got up and he like went nuts and he like wanted to get off the plane and he tried to open the door. They had to physically restrain this guy and they had to land the plane. And, you know, they explained to us that you really can't open a door when the plane's in flight. He tried, and they said didn't matter. He couldn't have gotten open, you know. So anyway.
Well, I think the way the doors work is they have to go in a little pivot and then go out, and because of the pressure inside versus out, you're right. That's
right.
Yeah. But after that, we go from they're plummeting to their death to again cutting to earlier. The story went from sometime to earlier to later to now to 2 hours later. Literally, those were the captions. And it anytime you've got to be bouncing one sequence and events around in time like that, that's always a warning sign for me as to a weak story potentially. And
now, while we're on that earlier panel, really, you know, second, it looks like the title of the story is Grifter 17 Minutes. Being not on the title page, that really, the kind of spirity thing where, you know, you have this, looks like it's sitting on a shelf with the shadows coming off of it. That really didn't work for me.
I'm wondering if the production guys maybe decided to put the credits and stuff on the previous page versus that page where they had expected it to be.
I don't know. It just
the part that got me was not only that, but the 17 minutes, you then read the caption earlier, it's like, well, was this 17 minutes earlier? That doesn't make sense either. I mean, it...
Is the whole story supposed to take place in 17 minutes?
Well, he is out for 17 minutes, or 17 hours, or 17 days, depending who you ask or which caption you read. It was confusing.
Look, look how wide the street is on that same page. It's barely wider than this car.
It's, and it's an alley. Not a,
is it an alley?
Well, it's clearly the one Hal's jumping over in the last thing we read.
I guess. Because it's got trees and sidewalks.
Yeah,
so,
I know.
You know, it's just...
Hopefully it's a one-way street.
This is a whole different kind of art problem than I had with Frankenstein. On Frankenstein, the issue I had was I didn't care for the art. On this one, you know, I always, I don't know, I try to point out, it's like, there's really not bad art. You know, there's art that, you know, you are not to your liking. I think that I can safely say in this issue, there is actually some bad art. I mean, there is art that is got poor perspective. It's got basic misunderstanding of proportions. You know, there are just artistic mistakes in this issue.
I agree.
A lot
with
of them.
Artistic mistakes, certainly poorly researched, poorly in terms of scale and some of that. Certainly the airplane stuff, you're right, that's just bad. To me, it reeks of lazy art versus necessarily bad art. It's what they chose to draw wasn't the right thing, but they drew it kind of well, I guess is the distinction I'm trying to make there.
Well, I mean, you go right back. It's like, go to the page after the Batman The Dark Knight ad.
Okay.
Here's another one. He's standing in the street in front of Louis Mardi Gras costumes. There's another street that's absurdly narrow.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and where the traffic light placement is seems a little odd. I can't disagree. Well, the sign for Louis or whatever on the side seems, I guess it's saying wigs, I guess. I don't know. It just seems weird. And I agree with that.
It's just
the fact they've got the hats and all those displays out in the open doesn't make sense, but
it seems like it's like the middle of the night, so having a rack of hats sitting outside would be ill-advised.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense, but I don't know if that's a problem with the art or if that's what the story said.
I don't know.
Either way, it's not good for the end comic, and I agree with you entirely on that.
Harbinger's on this page with opposite the Dark Knight, and it's kind of interesting in this one, because she seems to be floating in the air through the window in that lower panel. And most of the other places we see him, her kind of like standing on the ground. So that's kind of an interesting change
the
up.
Flight or hovering power. And this is one of the few where it seems like the character is really looking at the title character here. I get that sense more here than in some of the others. What gets me is Grifter, though, in that same panel, is grabbing a hat and what looks like a rag or a bandana or whatever just to wipe his hands off, shoves it in his pocket. At the end, that happens to just magically be his signature look from the old stuff. There were aspects of both the name and the mask and stuff that were just poorly sold, I thought, in this issue. If you go to opposite the New York Comic-Con ad, at the bottom, the guy he's just conned, he's like, "Damn, Grifter conned me." He gets called a grifter about 8 times or whatever it feels like, maybe not that many, but a number of times in this issue. Aside from maybe the show Leverage, con artist is the more common terminology than grifter. It just felt forced and didn't work for me there. And the other thing is, aside from the Hooded Woman showing up there, is there anything in this that remotely anchors it to the DC universe at all? I didn't see a single thing. I didn't see a gratuitously placed DC logo like we saw in, I think it was Batwoman this week. I didn't see any reference to any other character, really, that would put it into the DC universe. No LexCom or LexCorp or, you know, Wayne Industries or anything of the sort, even remotely. Maybe it's in here and I just missed it. It just, I don't think it set up the character well. I don't think it told the story well. Again, he's talking about, well, gee, what happened to me in those 17 minutes? What happened to the 17 minutes? His girlfriend or whatever, it's like, you were out for 17 days. And then at the end, he is trying to figure out, I want my 17 hours back. Which is it? I'm confused. I don't like coming out of a story confused like that. It's confused in a bad way.
Yeah.
To me, this is a 2. I was very disappointed with this. I thought it was a hard sell to begin with, to take a Wildstorm character, which I've read and liked, but I don't think most people have that background. Try to insert it very poorly into the DC universe, which again, I don't think they firmly established they did, and tell the story poorly. It's like it lost on almost all counts.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, this bandana or whatever he picked up, I have never seen a bandana with eye holes in it. I've never seen a mask that is a bandana. I've never seen one, you know, it's like got the little, you know, swoosh kind of black things going down. It's just like, it seems like something he picked up randomly. And then all of a sudden, it's the whole getting him in the mask. First off, it should have happened earlier than the last panel. And they should have done something to make it seem like he was not just, it's not just some rag he's wiping his face on, and then all of a sudden he ties it to his head and it's got eye holes and stuff. It just seemed weak.
Why does he even need a mask?
Well,
that seems like it would attract attention.
Because, you know, normally, you have every action movie you've ever seen where various kind of things happen, you know, like you don't see Bruce Willis or, you know, Schwarzenegger or, you know, Jason Statham, like tying a bandana across their face when they're going to confront the guys who did something to him, right? It's just, you know, he's kind of set up as this character that you've seen in movies all the time that it would never occur to any of these characters to put on a mask. So there was no motivating reason for him to do that.
Exactly. It seems like the only reason we got that mask and the term grifter is because of legacy aspects of the character that they failed to establish here. So, I mean, what rating would you give this?
I would give it a 2 also.
Yeah.
And in fact, I kind of said that the Frankenstein one was my least favorite book of the week, and I think I have to recant that because upon consideration, this one probably has to win that honor.
I can see that. Move on to the next one?
Yes. Please.
As fast as possible.
Legion Lost, number 1.
This is one that spins out of the free plot. Wow, it's getting hard to say these things. The pre-Flashpoint Legion of Superheroes series. And I forget exactly what page of what panel or whatever, but they really set that up at one point many, many months ago. And it's good they set it up there. It's unfortunate they didn't really set it up here. We get a time bubble crash, the opening splash. You don't really see that too often, which is probably a good thing. They mention the Flashpoint break wall that they had to like crash through or whatever, and okay, they reference that a time or two, I think, in the Legion stuff. But this is pulling out of stories that happened a good couple of months ago as kind of a side thing, not really a ooh, focus on this, it's gonna pay off later. And there were things here that just felt incredibly forced. The flight ring's not working. That struck me as particularly odd, given that over in Justice League International, Booster seems to work just fine. It was convenient for a lot of these things to happen. And the issue serves to get the characters kind of into the current day, have the first little tiny mini-adventure, but doesn't really give me a sense of the direction of the overall series or where this is going, how long this is, like, theoretically going to last. Are they stuck here forever, a long time, whatever? It felt like there was a lot of quote-unquote action, but it lacked context, it lacked meaning. It was like a roller coaster ride that really wasn't going anywhere. And I've read previous Legion series, you know, particularly the one that spins out of, don't really recall, like I said, the details of when all that happened or whatever, but I'm a big Legion fan, and I went into this expecting to like it, wanting to like it. It was good, but not great. And as something to introduce people to the Legion, this was abysmal.
Yeah, I would have to agree. I didn't get a strong introductory feeling on these characters, you know, to make me, I mean, if I'm picking this up out of the blue with no Legion background, I just thought this was, in that respect, very confusing. You know, it's like, what's going on here? And the art, Pete Woods, he did that action run with, wasn't he working on that Luthor stuff?
Yeah.
In action, and a lot of his art style's very different here than what I recall.
Mm-hmm. Now, I do want to give Fabian Nietzsche's some credit in terms of trying to be accessible in some respects. He does name the characters. He does give some sense of, well, so-and-so is using their telekinesis to control the shape-shifting of this other character. And so some of that, they get some high marks on. But that's more the minutiae than the big picture. This just seemed to be moving chess pieces on the board.
There were some interesting, there are interesting ideas to it. I'll give it that. I mean, I like the, okay, you know, are we going to get some explanation of some of the flashpoint stuff? You know, when they mentioned that she said the flashpoint break wall, you know, are we going to get some insight into things that happened here? I kind of like the, you know, they're having to stop this, you know, disease kind of thing. Well, some of them seem to be succumbing to it themselves. The, you know, disabling of the flight rings and stuff seems to have been a plot device that was then almost immediately overcome by people saying, oh, well, we could fly for these reasons anyways. It's like, well, okay, well, maybe that'll play in later where it's going to make a big difference that they don't have the flight rings or something.
Well, I think they were setting that up to where some of their other technology that was failing wasn't just out of the blue. So what's, I don't know. I had a bigger problem, I mean, because they mentioned the transuit filters not working and stuff, too, and that one of the computery things wasn't working. The part about the technology that annoyed me the most is if you look at the opening splash when they're breaking through or whatever, crashing out of the time bubble, it looks, I don't know, big enough to hold them, but not much bigger. You know, I'm trying to think of like 12, 15 feet or whatever. Yet when they're patching it up or whatever, further on after the Lego ad, it just seems to have like doubled in size or something. The scale on that thing just kept fluctuating, which annoyed me.
I did think it was interesting, and maybe this is where it'll come into it, because it's the flight ring that has the kind of universal translator in it, right?
I was thinking that was a different device, like their telepathic earplugs or part of their transuits or...
Whatever it is, it doesn't seem to be working because, you know, when they're in the hospital, you know, someone's saying, what language are they speaking? You know, it's kind of, so they're speaking Interlac. So it's going to ultimately probably play into the story that people aren't going to be able to understand them and they're not necessarily going to be able to understand anybody else.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that'll play out pretty quick. One question I've got, and this goes back to my poor memory or whatever, when did Wildfire's suit have that black kind of a look to it? Is that new, or was that prior and I just forgot?
I don't recall.
Okay, so we're on the same boat. Like I said, I really wanted to like, they've done this kind of a let's strand Legionnaires in the 20th century before, you know, current day before, a few times. This, I thought, was one of the weaker intros into that. For me, this gets a 3 out of 5. It's not all bad. It's got some decent stuff in places, but it was, in terms of a start to a series, setting up their status quo and all that, I was not amused. I was not pleased.
Yeah, I gave it a 3 also. Harbinger sighting on the, go to where the swamp thing ad is, and then flip the page one farther, top panel as the, big alien guy is walking, thumb, thumb, thumb. We've got the Harbinger with a little glowy effect.
Yeah.
Okay, next up we got Mr. Terrific, a story by Eric Wallace, coming off of, he was doing Titans, right?
I was thinking it was J.T. Cruel. Maybe it was, I don't remember. I could be wrong.
And then Gianluca Gugliotta is doing the art on this. I liked it. I thought that there were some, well, say, some of the things I had problems with in this was just the dialogue. There were pieces of dialogue in this issue that I just actively had a problem with. And that's just me personally. It's nothing, you know, it's like when he saves the Ferris wheel and he says, actually, a simple thanks, black guy, for saving us from a homicidal lunatic wearing weaponized body armor will do. It's just, things like that didn't work for me. You know, it's like overly long, overly convoluted. A simple thank you would be sufficient or something like that. You know, it's just...
Yeah, no, I can see that.
Overdone.
I like this a lot. I mean, basically, it started with a good opening splash page. We see the character in action and stuff. I thought that got it off to a strong start. I like the opening action sequence overall pretty well. It was good. It had a few things. There was something about the way he was using the T-spheres to kind of zip down to the London Eye that was kind of cool. Particularly the guy saying, oh, looks like a space biker riding three snooker balls or whatever. It's like, you know, I don't know. It's an interesting mode of transportation. It was used well here. It's not new, but I liked it. I'm sorry to see his wife, Paula, still dies in this continuity. I was hoping that we might get a Mrs. Terrific kind of a thing going, which would be fun. The twist they introduce with Aaron, fascinating. I'm really curious where that's going to go. I think that adds a lot to the series. We get Karen Starr, who is of Starware Industries or Starware Business or whatever, that is obviously a close friend of Michael Holt, Mr. Terrific. She used to be, you know, Power Girl, but we don't know if any of the JSA backstory has happened or exists post-crisis, so don't know if she's Power Girl or not. For that matter, I'm not entirely sure why Michael Holt is Mr. Terrific. I think they set up Michael Holt and his status quo well, but not really why he became the hero he did. He could have helped people other ways. I did feel like there was quite a bit of story in this issue. I was pleased with that, and I think the art really fit the material and worked pretty well. They had some cool ideas here. I really liked the tea sanctuary. And this is something that, you know, could the art be a little better in places? Yeah. Could the story have been a little better? The dialogue? Yeah. I was pleased, though. This is one that worked well for me. And, you know, when they first said, oh, they're going to give this guy his own ongoing series or whatever, solo character, lead character, I wasn't sure if he could sustain it. But I was pleased with this. I thought it worked well.
Yeah, I wasn't that taken with the justification for him becoming Mr. Terrific, the son from the future kind of thing. It seemed less compelling than some of the previous rationales that have been given for, you know, instead of him coming to it himself, it's like he's being told it by somebody else.
I didn't take that as his motivation for becoming Mr. Terrific so much as his motivation to not commit suicide. Because he was ready to basically, you know, blow the thing up. He wanted to die, and then that said, don't give up. Okay. But I'm still uncertain how he went from that to being a superhero.
Well, hopefully they'll explain that as time goes on.
Yeah.
Okay. So I gave it a 3. It was okay. It didn't completely sell me. One of Steven's favorite books of the week, so I think I will keep on getting it since he liked it a lot. I was kind of like, you know, I was okay on it. Left to my own devices, I may or might or might not have gone with it, but since he liked it a lot, I'll keep on getting it.
For me, it was a very strong 4. Again, I think there's a couple of things they could have done a little better here and there, but I was very pleased. And you know, I liked the character before, but they gave me what I needed to like him now here. So I think it was an effective first issue, too. I can see we're not going to click with everyone. I can see where you're coming from on that. Hopefully you'll warm to it over the next couple issues.
Oh,
move on to the next.
Do we do our Harbinger in this?
Oh, that's on page 2, panel 2, far right.
Page 4.
Is it page 4? Maybe I miscounted.
You missed the double page spread there.
Oh, I missed
opposite the cobalt there. Gum.
That is correct, yeah.
Face looks very masculine.
It almost looks like the Medusa mask from Psycho Pirate.
It's got an elongated chin. Anyway,
yeah,
it's from artist style. It's really reading way too much into that, but it certainly doesn't look consistent between all the books. So,
not too surprising. Given
if it ends up having to be the same character, you know, it's like, well, continuity editing could have been a little bit better. Okay, Red Lanterns. I'll go into this saying it's kind of like similar to my Deathstroke thing. Red Lanterns, I have never been my favorite characters. This whole thriving on rage and hatred and stuff is just not in my, you know, top of my stack of motivations. But, you know, that said, you know, a lot of people do like it. It's obviously popular enough to get a whole series, and I think DC also knows that a lot of people like this Dextar character, you know, this Green Lantern cat.
Red Lantern.
Red Lantern cat, yeah. So, you know, they know which side their bread's buttered on. You got this giant blood plasma breathing cat, like, killing all kinds of people in the first few pages. And then you have another character. It seems like the only characters that ever do anything in the Red Lanterns is Atrocitus, Dexstar and this Bleeze character. And Bleeze's dialogue is just really irritating to read.
Yeah, I would agree with that. This was one that, follows up from the War of the Green Lantern Aftermath stuff. Unsurprising, I expected that. There is a ton of expository voiceover in this issue. We get a couple of scenes where we get some other characters, like we get this Raymond and John after their grandfather got his head bashed in or whatever. And, they're presumably going to become Red Lanterns, but at this point, who are they and why should I care? Yes, there's some rage there, so it's going to lead to something, but as far as this single issue went, it was unsatisfying. We got a ton of backstory exposition about Atrocitus, the Red Lanterns, all this stuff, and it's just droning on and on. Too much backstory, too much foreshadowing, too little current story being shown. We're getting told the story, and that's something I was unimpressed with. You know, I didn't dislike it, but man, it totally failed to hook me or sell me on the series. And I like the Green Lantern titles. I've got nothing against the Red Lanterns per se, but this really did nothing for me.
I really still don't quite get the deal with the Red Lanterns. You know, it's like just going around filled with rage continually. It doesn't seem like they could even stand around and talk.
Well, particularly the level of rage they've got, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's like one thing, it's like the cat, I mean, it's just like flying around, ripping people apart. It's like, okay, it's just like in this constant state of rage, you know. And these other ones, there's like a whole bunch of them standing around on this planet, chatting it up. It's like, well, how exactly does that happen? How do they really stay in this?
Chatting or just fighting with each other?
I don't know, maybe. It seems like they do a lot more damage if they were fighting with each other.
Yeah, that's true. This was another
one
I was.
Not that Bleeze as much of a conversationalist.
Yeah. I really don't have a lot to say on this because I don't feel we got a lot new material. I don't know that anyone who hasn't read Blackest Night or some of the stuff leading up to that, which really set up the Red Lanterns, would really know what to make of this or why. It doesn't seem to have the level. I mean, it's got the accessibility because it's got the backstory and the exposition, but it doesn't have. It doesn't suck you into the story. I don't know what term to use for that, but it's not one that just grabs you by the collars and says, get into the story, you will enjoy it. You know what I mean? Matter of fact, with the level of exposition and stuff, it almost does the opposite for me. This seemed like a zero-issue teasing the series versus the actual start of the series. I mean, to me, I'm torn between giving it a 2 or a 3, and I'm leaning towards the 2. I was disappointed with this.
I gave it a 3. I thought, again, it was much like Green Lantern for me in that it was an obvious follow-on with little change from, you know, pre-Flashpoint, you know, Green Lantern stuff, which makes sense because they have not tweaked Batman and Green Lantern that much because they were already selling, you know, at the top of the sales charts for DC. So they kind of were following a if it isn't broke, don't fix it kind of methodology, which I can't fault them for. But, you know, as you say, I'm not sure that someone coming in cold on this that didn't read Blackest Night is going to get a whole lot out of this issue.
And that's fair, and you're right, it does follow on before, and I'm going to go with the 3, actually, a low 3, because it didn't actively necessarily turn me off, it just left me at kind of that blah state.
Yeah. This is another one where I'm not that turned on by it, but it was one of Steven's favorite books of the week. He really liked it, so I'll probably keep on getting it, on that respect, you know, because he likes it a lot.
He liked this one. He liked Deathstroke. Both of these are about people who go and kill. I'm just saying.
It's like get a lock on my bedroom door. So you read our Harbinger sighting standing in the alley, a top panel opposite the Batman Dark Knight ad as the two brothers are walking along talking to each other.
Yeah.
You at least have a street that appears like two cars could pass one another in opposite directions.
So if you ever wonder why traffic is so bad in the new DC universe, you know, go back to that Grifter comic and you'll know why.
Well, I mean,
nobody can pass. There's not room.
Two cars can pass each other in this, but barely. And there's certainly no room for anybody to park on this.
They're going to scrape each other. That's going to cause road rage. Oh, wait, this is Red Lanterns. That works.
Yeah, There you go. In fact, you know, it'd be funny if they did a Red Lantern thing where they're just flying over the freeway in Los Angeles or something during a traffic jam, like with red rings, like flying into all kinds of cars.
That would be funny.
Okay, next up, our torture issue of the week, Suicide Squad. If you ever wondered what Harley Quinn would look like if she walked around in lingerie all day long, this series will be the one for you. This one I had really, really mixed feelings about.
How so?
Well, I kind of like Suicide Squad in general. I mean, I like the idea of taking the bad guys and kind of like turning them into good guys and stuff. But, you know, it's bad enough if you know, take the bad guys and they're in prison and you put the little bomb in their head and stuff so they don't betray you. Well, okay, you know, they're bad guys. You got to do something or else they just immediately, when you take them off the leash, they're going to, you know, be off into the woods and you're never going to see them again. But, you know, standing around for an entire issue like torturing them to and, you know, see which one's going to like give up a name. A little over the top for, I guess maybe it's setting the tone for Amanda Waller's organization in this version of the DC Universe. But, you know, it's a little over the top, I thought.
I'm not going to say I condone it, but I can see Amanda Waller doing it. What I can't see is her doing it so blatantly and admitting to having done it. If they had come out of it thinking that was just a crappy first mission and not realizing it had just been a test, that would have worked better. Because
I
now
think
all it
that's a
does
good point.
is it builds up resentment. I mean,
Yeah.
you're encouraging them to go off the reservation. I mean, come on. That's bad tactics. This was one of those. I mean, I liked the original Suicide series, but Suicide Squad. Man, it's just too many titles. Suicide Squad series back in the day for much the same reasons you did. I like the idea of taking some of these villainous characters, putting them to heroic use, if not necessarily making them heroes. And if nothing else, using them as cannon fodder. I mean, it gives you more story potential for some of the villain characters. Otherwise, you can only use them every so often as, hey, they broke out of jail, they robbed another bank, or what have you. You know, it allows you to do some recurring stuff, and that really was one of the series that built up Deadshot back in the day. He was a longtime member of the old Suicide Squad, so having him here made sense. Now, going in, I didn't really care for the visuals of the new Harley Quinn. It's too much based on the game versus the comic, which is really based on the old cartoon version of the character. So I had concerns going in as to how much were they really gonna be conceding the character to other interpretations, if you know what I mean. It seems like they're giving up a certain ownership of the character by saying, you know, we really didn't know what to do with the character for the last decade or two, so this one video game will just take adopt their take on the character. It's like,
I think it's a common thing with the relaunch. They appear to be whichever is the interpretation that more people outside of comics are familiar with, that's the one that they're going to go with. You
oh,
know,
clearly.
it's like Green Arrow that we talked about last week. I mean, he looks a lot more like the guy that you saw in Smallville. Harley Quinn looks like in the Arkham video games, and you know, hey, I'm sure way more people have, you know, played those video games recently. Although on Harley, you could have the case because that cartoon show was out for a long time, and a lot of people are familiar from the cartoon show
And
with the other interpretation.
that's what I was going to push back with, is I think the cartoon overrides, but
Now, another thing that's caused a lot of angst for people, and people have been commenting about it on our forum as well as other places, is the Angela Bassett interpretation of Amanda Waller, where she kind of looks like she did in the Green Lantern movie, and a lot of people are just all up in
I didn't even
arms.
know she was in the Green Lantern movie.
Oh, because you haven't seen the Green Lantern movie.
Nope, wait for it to come out on DVD.
Well, she's played by Angela Bassett in
I
the Green
gathered
Lantern
that.
movie and looks much like she does here on the second to the last panel of this comic book. You
Yeah,
know,
she
and
was clearly recast.
a lot of people are like, oh, how come Amanda Waller is not this heavy woman anymore? And it's like, well, you know, they're making her look like in the movie.
Well,
So.
this was also isn't that different from how she showed up in Smallville. So, I mean, I can see the recasting of the character, and frankly, don't really care that much about that. I'm more worried about when they revamp again. What was one of the few really solid contributions into the comics from the Batman animated series. I didn't see the need to. And, you know, I don't mind the new Harley. Charlotte Eustis, she seems fine. It's just I'm more concerned about why they're making some of these changes than the fact they're making some of these changes. I did like seeing Black Canary in Harley's flashback, kind of reestablishing that that character still exists.
I thought it was entertaining as they're like traipsing through the snow. Mm-hmm. And that one scene, Harley's wearing her little thigh-high stockings, booty shorts, corset. But, of course, she has this short bomber jacket, so that's going to make her not be cold. It's not zipped up or anything. You know, it's like, what?
Well, she's crazy.
I know, I guess. She's crazy enough not to feel the cold.
I
hope they don't go around in leather jackets a lot, though.
All right, in that same panel, we've got a good shot of the new King Shark with the eye stalks or whatever.
It's a hammerhead now.
Hammerhead, yeah, it just looks lame. I don't like that. But I'm expecting him to be cannon fodder pretty soon anyways. I thought this issue did some decent backstory for the characters, but really failed to do much more than assemble the team for the most part. And we're promised some good action and some casualties next issue, at least some casualties. My vote is pretty much everybody but Harley and Deadshot. This El Diablo, Black Spider, King Shark, Voltiac, or whatever, kill them all, I don't care.
Yeah. Pretty much is like, I have no investment. Deadshot and Harley are the clear stars of this book, so.
I'd like to see them flesh out who's in the prison system or prison they're pulling from or whatever, and I'd like to see as some get thrown into jail from other titles, they get used, and
yeah,
we get some clear rotation in this, and maybe have more than one team going simultaneously. And if they want to go with a high-action thing and let's just rotate some characters in and out, that's fine. But this is one that I thought was good but not great. It didn't really give me enough to really decide on the series yet. We'll see how it goes. And for me, it was a 3 out of 5. Not bad, not great.
Yeah, I gave it a 3 out of 5 also. It's in my let's wait and see category. Now, the Harbinger sighting, this one was kind of interesting, that it happens on the fourth page of the story. She's kind of standing really close to the one guy torturing Deadshot.
Seems like she's almost right next to Harley.
Yeah, I guess that she's... So, I mean, that speaks really clearly that, you know, pretty much every place else, it's been like kind of out in a publicly accessible kind of location. And this is like inside a building. She's not looking in through a window or anything. She's like physically in and, you know, you'd notice someone, so it's pretty obvious now with this one anyway that she's not visible to anyone. The other ones, you could always say, oh, she wasn't noticed off in the crowd or something, or just standing over in this public location. But in this one, there's no way they wouldn't notice this individual standing in their torture room who didn't belong there if she was visible to anybody.
Agreed, so agreed.
That seems to nail that fact down. Okay, and next up we've got, or last up, I guess, is Superboy. I was really surprised by this one. I kind of went in, you know, with the cover and everything, and, you know, I'm not a big fan of the cover of this, but the way that the story played together, I was really surprised and really pleased with both the story and the art in this issue.
I would agree with that. I was a little afraid we were either going to get a retread of the original clone Superboy from the comics or what we just got in the Young Justice cartoon series or something like that. And while there are a couple of aspects here that have been done before, I mean, the entire body brain aspect thing we've seen before, who cares? It's a nice twist, and it makes this character different from prior ones. And I like how they're very much playing up from the get-go his anatomy, his physiology, his whole way of being is different than a normal human. You just can't measure him the same way. You know, he operates just differently, and I thought that was well set up and cool. Now, I was a little frustrated that this redheaded doctor doesn't get a name in the first scene or anywhere in the issue.
Well, I'm guessing because there's a little bit of her name on the opposite page from the big, mostly naked Superboy splash page, right previous to the New Guardians.
Okay, let me go flip to that. Okay.
It says, identify yeah. Dr. Kate. I'm guessing this is Caitlin Fairchild.
I was thinking Fairchild anyways,
and,
yeah.
And it's gonna play into like kind of a Gen 13 thing at some point.
That makes sense. That's who I was going to guess anyways.
That's who I was thinking, and then, you know, that seemed to, you know,
that definitely give a strong plays towards indicator. It, yeah.
But I really like, and I, the other thing I really thought was cool was the virtual reality thing. Because you're playing along and it doesn't seem, and then, you know, they kind of pull the rug out, and it's like, okay, you know, let's rerun that simulation. I thought that was well done.
I loved the whole exchange between him and Rose Wilson. And she's like, well, do you have any issues with the whole empathy, good and evil, and all that stuff? And he's like, oh, I don't think so. Meanwhile, there's this lady in this house burning behind them kind of
yeah.
thing. It's like, ooh, wow, interesting. And I love how that plays into who the human donor had to be. And their phrasing is, so unless Superboy's human cells originated in a deeply pathological megalomaniacal narcissist, the likes of which the world has never seen.
Except
we did something
Lex
wrong.
Luthor, yeah.
I'm like, oh wait, we saw him in Action Comics.
Yeah.
You know? And that was kind of defining one character in reference to another. It was fun.
Excellent, excellent comic though. One of the top ones I read of the week. It absolutely earned a spot on my pull list. Really well done. Art and story.
Yeah.
Just some really nice character moments, nice dialogue moments, nice setup, good chunk of story, good mystery setup. And it is actually kind of leading us, you know, giving us a little bit of a Teen Titans preview there at the end, which makes that kind of make a little bit of sense too. So overall, I thought this was a really well done issue.
I did too. I thought this was great. I didn't expect to see Rose Wilson here. I don't know how different this one is from the pre-Flashpoint version. Is she still Deathstroke's daughter or not? But it was a good use of the character regardless. I'm curious what this Nowhere stands for. It's clearly an acronym or whatever, but we'll figure that out someday. The use of the VR was really good. Some of the detail stuff, like when we get the full page splash, full page of Rose, when she gets the real version of her gets introduced. Top panel, there's on the screen Superboy getting kind of removed from the VR simulation to where they can go, you know, deal with him in reality. Nice little kind of a detail there. The use of Lois Lane was good. The person who's feeding her information, interesting. I want to see where they go with this. And I'm really curious where the next issue of this series goes versus, say, the first issue of Teen Titans. Because, like you said, they're right there on that last page, and it sets up a definite crossing of paths. Sort of thing. I thought the use of the voiceover caption narration for Superboy was excellently done. Mm-hmm. It gave a really good counterpoint to what we were seeing and his take on it, and I loved that.
Yeah.
And the art by R.B. Silva, great.
Absolutely fantastic. I mean, it's just really clean. It was really appealing to my eye. I really like his art, and it was a really good match for the story.
Yeah. I mean, to me, this was a 5 out of 5. This was tons better than I was afraid it might be. I was expecting something highly derivative, and it was not.
Yeah, and it's really, you know, kind of almost complete standalone from the Superman family books. I mean, other than, you know, he's got half Kryptonian DNA. I mean, it's not, at least currently, that tied into any of the Superman stuff. You know, so this, and I guess the reason I'm saying that is that someone can pick this up and read it even if they don't plan to read Superman or are not interested in the Superman character. It's a different enough take, and it's just really interesting and pretty cool.
I am curious if we'll find out when they got some of Superman's DNA and who got presumably Lex Luthor's to mix into it, and if Lex knows, and, you know, some of the details on that will pan out over time, no doubt.
Yeah.
But a lot of questions raised, but in a good way.
In this issue, we have our Harbinger sighting, second to the last page of story in the upper right panel. She's kind of standing on the roof there off to the side as Fairchild is talking to that guy by the helicopter.
So what rating for you?
5 also.
Okay, cool.
And just jumped right onto my pull list. You know, great, great issue.
Yeah. And for me, the best of the week was Demon Knights, Mr. Terrific, and Superboy. Resurrection Man was also pretty good. We talked about elsewhere. They're just doing some good stuff.
Yeah, my top three were probably Superboy, Demon Knights, and Resurrection Man. Demon Knights in first place, and then Superboy and Resurrection Man very close behind. great, great books. And Batwoman and Green Lantern kind of, you know, pulling it up in the high four range as well for the week.
Again, both of those I thought were good as follow-ons to what had happened before, but it's hard for my perception of these not to be colored by the, it's new, it's a relaunch,
You know, I agree, and that's why they weren't at the top. You know, they were still really solid books, but not as number one-y as they could have been.
Cool.
So, 2 weeks down, two to go.
Yep.
There are 25 comic books to go.
Yeah. So, anything else? Does that pretty much do it?
I think that does it for me.
Cool. The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.